group urged the United Nations and humanitarian organizations, including the International Committee of the Red Cross, to take urgent action to uncover the fate of thousands of missing civilians in Rafah. This came as Israel's military has confirmed firing on ambulances last Sunday in Rafah's Tel al-Sultan neighborhood, labeling them as suspicious vehicles. Now let's get a clearer picture of the situation with our correspondent in Khan Yunis, Ahmed al-Najjar. Ahmed, I hope you're well. What do you have to share with us?
Well, Kirash, as of the past 2 hours, the scene here in southern Gaza in general and in Khan Yunis and Rafah in particular has been incredibly horrific and marked by a surge of attacks that were carried by the Israeli occupation. In Khan Yunis alone, at least 4 airstrikes took place. One of them was carried within the Al-Mawasi area in western Khan Yunis that targeted a displacement tent within a tented camp that killed one man and injured at least 4 others. Within the southern parts as well of Khan Yunis, within Gizan and Najjar town, a carriage pulled by a donkey and boarded by several people was targeted also by a drone strike, killing 4 people there and injuring many others who were at the street at that time. Within Abasan town in the eastern outskirts of Khan Yunis, just over the past hour, a residential building belonging to a Gdeh family was targeted as well, killing 6 members of the family and injuring dozens others. And we can still see the ambulances rushing just and bringing the injured to the hospital just over the past few minutes. These attacks were not just limited on the city of Khan Yunis, but also within the city of Rafah, in central Rafah, within Ash-Shabura camp. An airstrike targeted a group of people where there was a large number of children at the time, and this killed one little girl, and most of the injuries as well were of children. These attacks on Rafah and Khan Yunis has been escalating over the past days since the start of this second round of the genocidal campaign over the for more than 9 days now. This surge of attack on Rafah within the incursions that were carried by the Israeli occupation that trapped thousands of families in Rafah and forced thousands other to flee the area there. And unfortunately, we're not limited only on helpless civilians here, but on the crews that are risking their life to just help those trapped. And that is what happened to the different teams of the paramedics and the PRCS teams that went to Rafah more than 9 days, or more than 7 days now. They went last Sunday to rescue the teams, and just 2 days ago, in coordination with the United Nations Office for Humanitarian Affairs, was allowed, a team was allowed to move there to check on those 15 members of civil defense crews and paramedics, only to find that their vehicles were targeted and leveled, buried to the ground, and one of them just has been extracted. The fate of the 14 others is still missing till this now. On a daily basis, these teams here, the Ministry of Health, is launching appeals to reveal their fate and help even allow those teams, the remaining teams here, to go there again and check on them at a time where the blockade is preventing the entry of all needed supplies to not only extract or find out the fate of those paramedics and civil members, but also the thousands of people still missing under the rubbles. And that number is increasingly rising within the progression of time as more people are falling and still missing under the rubble, just like what happened within Gaza City over the past 24 hours within the targeting of Awad family, whose many of those family members are still missing under the rubble, in addition to several airstrikes that were carried overnight and claiming the lives of 2 more people within the Ash-Shuja'iyya neighborhood.
Thank you for that update. That was Ahmed al-Najjar reporting from Khan Yunis, southern Gaza. The detention of a pro-Palestinian Turkish student by the U.S. immigration authorities has sparked outrage and debate across the United States, with her friends describing the situation as horrifying.
That is terrifying. And it's terrifying for not only for me, who knows her very well, but it's probably terrifying for everyone else who would understand the situation here. Some of my friends and my students, actually, who are international and who are on valid visas, just like Rumeysa, they are really scared.
Rumeysa was targeted, you know, right at her home. I believe Mahmoud Khalil was as well. So it's just, yeah, it's very terrifying. But I think, you know, people want to keep resisting and keep organizing and fighting for justice, you know, both in Palestine and here locally.
Rumeysa Öztürk's arrest is the first known detention of a Boston area student involving pro-Palestinian activism under the Trump administration. Her detention comes a year after she co-authored an opinion piece in the school's student paper criticizing the university's ties to companies linked to Israel and calling for acknowledgement of the genocide of Palestinians by Israel. Critics have dismissed her arrest as an assault on free speech, while the Trump administration defends its actions. Over 30 Democratic lawmakers also condemned the arrest, saying it targets political views rather than public safety. Earlier this month, U.S. police arrested Mahmoud Khalil, a Columbia University student, over his participation in pro-Palestine protests. Political analyst John Bosnich says detention of pro-Palestinian students by U.S. authorities is completely against the U.S. Constitution.
The Trump administration is going to learn a lesson very quickly. It's established U.S. law that every person in the United States, regardless of their citizenship, enjoys the right of freedom of speech, so long as the woman in question here has not violated any laws in terms of destroying property or violence. There is no chance that she can be arrested and deported in violation of the U.S. Constitution. What she needs now is a good lawyer, and there are many lawyers who would take this case for free at no charge to her, who would assert the U.S. constitutional guarantee of freedom of speech. Unfortunately, in the United States, many of the universities are private, and these private universities are subject to the wishes of their donors. Now, in the United States, the donors tend to be very rich people, and many of them are connected to the U.S. government, to the U.S. military-industrial complex, and so on. So, if the universities receive pressure from their private funders to not allow freedom of speech on the campus, the universities themselves may use their campus security forces to violate the students' rights.
The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has strongly condemned a violent Israeli settler attack in the Misafer Yara area of the occupied West Bank, calling it an act of ethnic cleansing carried out under Israeli military protection. The attack, which took place on Friday morning, left 5 Palestinians seriously injured, including 17-year-old Qusay and his father. Settlers armed with rocks and metal pipes brutally bit the teen, who sustained a serious head injury, while his father suffered a brain hemorrhage and skull fractures. Following the attack, Israeli forces arrested over 20 Palestinians, falsely accusing them of attacking settlers. In a separate incident, Israeli settlers backed by military forces stormed a mosque east of Nablus, attacking Palestinian worshippers there. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has called for urgent international intervention to stop Israel's escalating colonial campaign of racial prosecution, genocide, forced displacement, and annexation. Israeli forces have intensified their raids on and incursions into the occupied West Bank. We were earlier joined by Naga Hamid, our correspondent in Ramallah, to give us more on the situation there.
Well, the Israeli restrictions and the Israeli, as it is called, security measures have intensified greatly since yesterday, as the IOF and the Israeli regime was trying to ban Palestinians from going into occupied Al-Quds, trying to keep inner Palestinians inside their own city. The Palestinian Red Crescent have informed about two two injuries inside Nablus, severely beaten two girls, two Palestinian girls, 18 and 14 years old women, were assaulted and beaten while the IOF raided their home in the hours of the morning in the area of Nablus. While, of course, we are seeing more intensified raids towards Nablus and towards their refugee camps, to be more precise. Al-Ain refugee camp, Askar and Balata refugee camps are being under attack, systematically under attack. And not very far from Nablus, Tamun, also in the provenance of Kubas, was raided, and many homes were reportedly, according to local resources, many homes where the IOF made incursions to those homes, detained tens of Palestinians to fieldly interrogate them and assaulted them. And then until this moment, the moon remains under siege, almost under siege, after the IOF is still working inside the moon.
The United States presses ahead with its aggression against Yemen, launching new airstrikes on various areas across the Arab country. Yemeni media say U.S. airstrikes hit Sa'ada, killing one person and wounding four others. The U.S. has reportedly carried out 14 strikes on the outskirts of Sa'ada city. The latest attack comes after the U.S. targeted more than 40 locations across Yemen, including in the capital, Sana'a, damaging multiple residential buildings and shops. The U.S. and its allies have escalated their aggression against Yemen after the country resumed its anti-Israel operations over the regime's renewed genocide in Gaza. Washington says it will use overwhelming force until the Ansarullah resistance movement stops in its anti-Israel operation. Millions of Iranians have taken to the streets across the country on the International Quds Day to express solidarity with Palestinians and to condemn Israeli atrocities against them. And the capital Tehran streets were flooded with demonstrators. Fatima Masumi has more.
Huge crowds rallying in the streets of Tehran to mark International Quds Day. Streets flooded with demonstrators from all backgrounds, waving the flags of Gaza and the Hezbollah resistance movement, holding placards and chanting slogans to show support for Palestinians and denounce Israeli atrocities. Senior officials were also present.
Today at 4 p.m. Venezuela time, our government and people will rally to mark this occasion, condemning the Israeli regime and supporting Palestine. The atrocities occurring can only be described as genocide. Today, in my opinion, is a significant day. The huge turnout of people demonstrates that our citizens understand the situation very well. Clearly, many political dynamics have changed since last year. This turnout reflects that the Islamic Republic of Iran relies on its people.
Quds Day is commemorated on the last Friday of Ramadan. It is a day of international solidarity with the Palestinian people. Just like previous years, Afghan community in Iran also joined other protesters to express their support for Palestinians in Gaza.
We consider Palestine our heart and soul. It is the heart of the Muslim world. Therefore, we urge all officials to take action.
I am here to condemn the Israeli attacks and the egregious atrocities they have committed in Gaza.
The people who participated in the rallies say their presence is a response to the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution's call.
I am here in response to our leader's call to come out and send a strong message to the world.
As the son of a martyr, I am here because our leader stated that this year's rallies are even more significant. This huge turnout shows that the resistance is stronger than ever.
As our beloved Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah once said, "We will never abandon Palestine. We are the Shia of Ali ibn Abi Talib, and we will never abandon Palestine, nor the people of Palestine."
The huge turnout in Iran is seen not only as a sign of unity and strength of the Iranian nation, but their steadfast support for the Palestinian resistance.
Iranians have once again resonated voices of solidarity with Palestinians on International Quds Day and strongly condemned their recent renewed Israeli bloodshed, expressing full support for the Palestinian cause. Fatah Masumi, Tehran.
The death toll from the massive earthquakes that hit Myanmar and Thailand has crossed 1,000 as rescuers continue to dig through the rubble to search for survivors. The 7.7 magnitude earthquake struck central Myanmar midday on Friday, followed minutes later by a 6.7 magnitude aftershock. Over 1,000 people were killed and more than 2,300 injured in the second biggest city, Mandalay, which is believed to be the worst affected. The toll is expected to rise significantly. In the Thai capital, 10 people were confirmed killed as a skyscraper under construction collapsed in seconds by the force of the shaking. Scores of workers are still unaccounted for at the building, with rescue operations underway. India, France, and the European Union have offered to provide assistance to Myanmar after the ruling military general issued a plea for international assistance. That's it for this bulletin. Thank you, Emma. Bye for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a number of distinguished reciters of the Holy Quran in a gathering titled Communion with the Holy Quran. This meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on the first day of the blessed month of Ramadan, March 2nd, 2025. The The Quran is the overall framework of individual and social life, the shape of social and individual life. A collection which the book contains it, clarifies it, and is an expression of it. And to teach them the book and the wisdom. Surah 62, verse 2. What is wisdom? It's knowledge and understanding of the truths of the universe. Something that allows people to grasp the truths of the universe. The recitation of the book teaches us these things. To recite to them, the Prophet, peace be upon him and his holy progeny, recites the Quran to the people in order to accomplish the following things. Purification, teaching the book and teaching wisdom. What do you do? You who are the reciters are doing the same work as the Prophet. You also recite. The act of recitation is a prophetic task. The recitation of the Quran is of such great importance that you can change Quranic concepts into ideas that are accepted by the general public. There are thousands of important titles and headings in the Quran. For example, consider this verse, so that people may maintain justice. Surah 57, verse 25. Adopt a policy excusing the faults of people. Surah 7, verse 199. And remember Allah with frequent remembrance. Surah 33, verse 41. All of these are different titles and headings. One of the duties and functions of your recitation, if done correctly, is to change these concepts into certainties accepted by society's thinking. It should become an established matter in society that one must maintain justice and that one must remember God. Remember Allah with frequent remembrance. That one must forgive his or her brothers and sisters. Adopt a policy of excusing the faults of people, that one must fight in the way of Allah, and the other concepts that exist in the Quran. This isn't an overstatement. There are thousands of titles, topics, and headings in the Quran that can become a part of the common intellectual knowledge of the general populace. What makes this possible? Good recitation. That's when the people's Quranic knowledge will increase and they will think in the way that the Quran has taught.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Since Israel's invasion of Palestine and the occupation of the Jordan River cities, many religious scholars express concern over the development. The religious scholars of Cairo, Medina, Istanbul, Qom, and Najaf reacted differently to the occupation. Following these reactions, Arab nations and states described the occupation of Palestine as a national and ethnic issue. leading to the formation of a joint Arab front. In those years, socialist movements in Arab countries united under the Ba'ath Party. However, after successive defeats of the joint Arab front against Israel, the fervor gradually died down and the countries accepted the situation. Under these circumstances, the scholars of Najaf and Qom had a different reaction to the Zionist occupation. They framed the Palestinian issue as an Islamic one, considering Israel's existence and the continuation of its occupation as opposition to Islam. Among these scholars was Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'eri, the founder of the Qom Seminary School. Among them, we can mention Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, one of Ayatollah Burujerdi's students, and Sayyid Musa Sadr, one of Allama Tabatabai's students. In the years following the Arabs' defeat by Israel, as many surrendered to Israel in one way or another, the Shia scholars of Najaf and Qom initiated a new movement based on Islamic values, rather than just national, ethnic, or Arab views. Meanwhile, Arab countries, mainly governed by pan-Arab and Ba'athist ideologies, were engulfed in internal strife, pushing the Palestinian issue to the sidelines. In Iran, the Pahlavi regime was closely aligned with Israel, to the extent that Iran was often considered another Israel. However, the people in Iran and Iraq, contrary to their governments, opposed Israel. Amid continued disputes between Mossadegh and the Shah over the closure of the Iranian embassy in Israel, Imam Khomeini began his struggle against the pro-Israel regime. In mid-1953, while many sought an end to the Shah's rule to eliminate foreign influence, for others it marked the beginning of a new movement. When Sayyid Musa Sadr graduated from Tehran University in 1953 with a degree in economics and law, he took a different path, leaving for Lebanon, a region under Israeli control. In the years following the defeat of the United Arab Army in 1948, nationalist socialist movements emerged in regional countries, evolving into powerful forces. New governments under the Ba'ath Party banner took power in Egypt, Iraq, Syria, and Jordan, all united by a common vision to restore Arab dignity. This national, or rather ethnic, pride fostered a collective spirit and determination to stand against Israel. During this period of rising ethnic pride, Sayyid Musa Sadr was actively working in Beirut, Lebanon, addressing the needs of the less privileged areas. Lebanon faced more social disunity compared to other Arab countries due to its religious, intellectual, and ethnic diversity, which prevented the regional fervor from taking root. Through his efforts in meeting various people and offering support, Sayyid Musa Sadr became a unifying figure in Lebanon. He engaged in debates within Lebanese intellectual movements, reaching out to Shia and Sunni religious groups, and supported oppressed communities. While Arab countries have been preparing to confront Israel for years, progress was not as anticipated. Imam Khomeini launched his campaign against the Pahlavi regime in Iran, having warned the Shah on numerous occasions through letters about the detrimental effects of American-Israeli policies. In June 1963, following his efforts to raise awareness through speeches, the Pahlavi regime decided to arrest Imam Khomeini and subsequently exiled him. The Shah believed that Imam Khomeini's movement was confined to Iran's borders, and that exile would resolve the issue. However, Imam Khomeini's goal was broader, to awaken the people across the entire region under Shia religious authority. After the people in Arab countries and their military movements felt their national ethnic pride had been awakened, Israel launched a preemptive strike to prevent their forces from integrating. On January 5, 1967, Israel captured the Gaza Strip, the West Bank of the Jordan River, the Sinai Desert, and the Golan Heights in just 6 days. Israel's territory expanded more than threefold in this short period. The Arabs, who had been preparing to confront Israel, were taken by surprise and found themselves in a weak position. Israel continued its advance, reaching within 40 kilometers of Damascus, which would have been a devastating blow to the United Arab Front. In response, Arab nations stood against Israel with all their might to mitigate the defeat. Iraq, coordinating with Egypt, reinforced forces in northern Syria to halt Israel's progress. Israel, having achieved significant success, did not engage in a war of attrition and set conditions for a peace deal that the joint Arab front eventually agreed to under those terms. The defeat in the Six-Day War dealt a harder blow to the Arab nations. A few years passed since that war, and Arab countries decided to retaliate and restore their lost reputation. During those years, the Shah of Iran had been investing a substantial amount of money in Israel's reconstruction. In Israel's most critical situations, the Shah provided a glimmer of hope by supplying the regime with oil. By not supporting the Arab movement, he indirectly strengthened Israel in its fight against the Arab states. Saturday, October 6, 1973. Syria from the north, followed by Egypt from the south, launched surprise attacks on Israel. Initially, the operation favored Syria and Egypt, but gradually, with foreign aid, Israel countered the Egyptian and Syrian armies on two fronts. The Egyptian army was surrounded by the Sinai Desert, and for the first time, Israel entered Egypt's main territory by crossing the west bank of the Nile. In the north, Israel penetrated deep into Syrian territory, with Israeli artillery striking the suburbs of Damascus. After days of intense conflict, on October 25, 1973, the battle finally ended with a UN resolution backed by the United States and the Soviet Union. However, the truce resulted in agreements that brought shame and silence for all Arab countries. During those years, Sayed Musa Sadr had emerged as a prominent leader for the people of Lebanon, earning him the title of Imam Musa Sadr. Imam Musa Sadr began his influential activities soon after arriving in Lebanon. 2 years before the Yom Kippur War, another Iranian, Mostafa Chamran, joined him in Lebanon to help expand his efforts. Chamran, who had studied plasma physics and electromechanics in American universities, was an activist leading student movements in the U.S. against the Shah of Iran. His arrival in Lebanon and meeting with Imam Musa Sadr prompted increasing monitoring by Iran's intelligence and security organization, SABAK, due to his proximity to Israel, the Shah's ally. Dr. Chamran's collaboration with Imam Musa Sadr aimed to organize Lebanese youth, particularly the Shia minority, who were involved in Lebanon's complex and tribal political landscape. With Musa Sadr's presence, they not only maintained structural integrity, but also acted with unity. Under the watchful eyes of SABAK and Mossad, Sadr and Chamran gathered Lebanese Shia youths at Jebel Amel High School, where they provided technical and professional courses. These efforts fostered a strong relationship between the Lebanese youth, Dr. Chamran, and Imam Musa Sadr. The situation in Lebanon, with its predominantly Christian structure, kept the country somewhat distanced from the conflicts between Israel and the Arab nations. However, the presence of displaced Palestinians in Lebanese camps and the establishment of Palestinian resistance forces in Lebanon consistently generated tension in southern Lebanon. Imam Musa Sadr seized this opportunity to teach military principles to members of Amal. Israel posed a direct threat to the Lebanese people. While Lebanese Christian leaders had an unwritten agreement with Israel, the Lebanese Shias were rising from the ashes of Arab pride, not with Arab ideology, but with the concept of Islamic resistance against Israel. After the Camp David Accords and Egypt's withdrawal as one of Israel's most formidable enemies, the path was cleared for Israel to pursue its objectives. One of these goals was to dismantle Palestinian groups dreaming of confronting Israel and liberating Palestine. In the years following the Arab War, Palestinian resistance groups had formed, establishing their headquarters near the Israeli-occupied territories in southern Lebanon, perpetuating regional conflict and tension. A few years after the Yom Kippur War in 1978, and before the victory of the Iranian Revolution, the most serious clashes between Palestinian resistance groups and the Israeli army began. Lacking substantial power, Palestinian forces were quickly forced out of southern Lebanon by Israel. However, Israel was not satisfied. The mere existence of Palestinian resistance groups meant the Palestinian dream remained alive. To crush that dream, these groups needed to be eliminated, alongside the Israelis searching for their adversaries in Lebanon. The Pahlavi regime was also hunting its opponents in the region. Iran's intelligence and security organization, SAVAK, had a strategic cooperation with Israel's Mossad since its establishment. Training SAVAK forces in Israel by Mossad and exchanging intelligence were key aspects of this cooperation. According to Mossad documents, SAVAK conducted activities abroad to ensure Israel's security and control opposition to the regime in regional countries. These activities included gathering intelligence and espionage in Egypt, Iraq, and Syria. One of the most sensitive countries for both SAVAK and the Mossad was Lebanon. Therefore, SAVAK sought to prevent Lebanon's unification with Egypt, Iraq, and Syria by influencing its ethnic and religious communities, including Christians and Shias, from the early years. SAVAK's mission was to ease Israel's concerns about Lebanon. The relative security of Lebanon had consequences for the Pahlavi regime. The relative peace in Lebanon and the country's non-interference in the Arab alliance against Israel made Lebanon a fertile ground for organizing and equipping Pahlavi opposition groups. Lebanon was a target for both SAVAK and Mossad in a deal where they supported each other. Mossad assisted SAVAK with training, equipment, and intelligence. However, these conditions gradually became more challenging for SAVAK, especially after an Iranian guest, well known by SAVAK forces, and the former head of SAVAK, Taimur Bakhtiar, went to Lebanon. After the coup on August 19, 1952, and the establishment of SAVAK, Taimur Bakhtiar was appointed as its first head. In the early years, organizing Iran's security situation, which still had significant opposition to the Shah and support for Mossadegh, or the Tudeh party, highlighted the importance of Bakhtiar's role in SAVAK. However, the longer Bakhtiar remained in his position, the more he became aware of the Pahlavi regime's corruption. In February 1961, when Bakhtiar was tasked by the Shah to deliver a message to John F. Kennedy, Kennedy's conversation with Bakhtiar about U.S. concerns over the corruption and inefficiency of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi's rule angered the Shah. Upset that Kennedy had shared these concerns with Bakhtiar, the Shah removed him from SAVAK within a month. Bakhtiar stayed in Iran for a few months, but his alignment with those opposing the Pahlavi regime was unacceptable to the Shah. Consequently, Bakhtiar was exiled a year later. Exile did not improve the situation. Bakhtiar openly expressed his opposition to the Shah and the ruling regime in West Germany, Italy, and Switzerland. Savak reports indicated that Bakhtiar was constantly under surveillance by Savak agents, who even accused him of an assassination attempt on the Shah. Additionally, Bakhtiar's frequent trips to Lebanon and his relationship with Imam Musa Sadr were major concerns for the Shah and Savak. During those years, Savak and the Shah made several attempts to influence the Amal movement by praising Chamran and Imam Musa Sadr, but these efforts failed. The Shah and Savak were aware of Imam Musa Sadr's influence in Lebanon, a concern shared by Israel, which had tasked Iran with controlling the Amal movement. However, the situation continued to deteriorate. On April 12, 1968, Tamur Bakhtiar visited Lebanon, as he had done on previous occasions. This time, however, he was arrested by Lebanese forces. The Shah, attempting to secure Bakhtiar's return, offered several million dollars in bribes to the Lebanese authorities and promised a special plane for his transfer under complete control. Despite these efforts, the Lebanese authorities refused to hand over Bakhtiar. Imam Musa Sadr intervened, asking the Lebanese authorities to release Bakhtiar, and his mediation led to Bakhtiar's eventual release. The Shah's attempt to arrest Bakhtiar and establish a successful relationship with Imam Musa Sadr and Chamran had failed. More importantly, Savak and Mossad were concerned about Imam Musa Sadr's growing influence among various Lebanese communities. With Sadr's power increasing, Israel had no choice but to kidnap Imam Musa Sadr. On August 31, 1978, Imam Musa Sadr traveled to Libya at the invitation of Muammar Gaddafi. After that trip, no one saw Imam Musa Sadr again. The Lebanese authorities pursued the matter, but Gaddafi claimed that Imam Musa Sadr had left Libya for Rome, a claim Italy immediately refuted. Despite frequent discussions, Lebanon was ultimately deprived of Imam Musa Sadr. A few months later, the Iranian Revolution would overthrow the monarchical regime allied with Israel. In Imam Musa Sadr's absence, the youth of Amal had only one hope, Dr. Chamran. However, with the victory of the Iranian Revolution, Chamran returned to Iran to serve his homeland, for which he had tirelessly worked to liberate. Upon Chamran's arrival in Iran, Amal's youths followed, utilizing their experiences from Lebanon to establish the headquarters of irregular warfare. The bond between Iran and Lebanon was stronger than Israel could have imagined. The roots cultivated over years under the shadow of Mossad and Savak had emerged. Consequently, Israel concluded that its survival depended on an attack on Lebanon to achieve its objectives there. January 6, 1982. As Iran and Iraq were deeply engaged in a war, Israel entered Lebanon under the pretext of combating Palestinian resistance movements. Israel occupied the Shia areas in southern Lebanon, resulting in the displacement of hundreds of thousands of people. The Maronite Christian forces, known as the Phalangs, aligned with Israel, making Lebanon unsafe for Shias and Palestinian resistance forces in the northern regions. The Amal movement forces emerged as the sole protectors of the Lebanese in this dire situation. Urban warfare had been raging in Lebanon for several months. Meanwhile, Iran was focused on fighting and recapturing its cities. These efforts culminated on May 24, 1982, with the liberation of Khorramshahr, Iran's most significant fallen city, which had become a symbol of resistance. After reclaiming Khorramshahr, Iranian forces began to concentrate their efforts beyond their borders, with Lebanon becoming a new focal point for them. June 13, 1982, Iran, in coordination with the Supreme Council of Defense, sent forces from the Muhammad Rasulullah Brigade under the command of Ahmad Mutawassilian to Lebanon. The brigade's mission was to assist Lebanese forces and fight against Israel. Initially, the Iranian forces were deployed to Damascus and then transferred to Lebanon via land routes. A few days after their arrival, Imam Khomeini became aware of their presence and, prioritizing the Iranian fronts, ordered their return to Iran. Consequently, the Mohammad Rasulullah Brigade returned to Iran and was stationed on Iran's fronts. However, Ahmad Mutavassilian and several other commanders remained in Lebanon to complete their mission. Mutavassilian, one of the most experienced Iranian commanders, had extensive combat experience from the war in Iran's Kurdistan against the so-called Democratic Party, making him adept at leading urban warfare and organizing forces. These capabilities had gone unnoticed by Israel. The presence of such a commander in Lebanon was concerning for Israel. With no news of Imam Musa Sadr and Dr. Chamran, Ahmad Mutavassilian established a new line of resistance in Lebanon. July 4, 1982. A meeting was held at the Iranian embassy in Beirut to evaluate the activities and achievements of Ahmad Mutavassilian and the Mohammad Rasulullah Brigade in Lebanon. It was decided that all remaining groups of Iranian troops in Lebanon would travel to Damascus on July 6th and return to Iran. Sayed Mohsen Mousavi, the chargé d'affaires of the Iranian embassy, suggested that before returning, they could visit Baalbek and the suburbs of Beirut to inspect the region and prepare a report. On the morning of July 5, 1982, Ahmad Mutavassilian, Iranian diplomat Mousavi, and two Iranian journalists, Taghir Astigar Moghaddam and Kazem Akhavan, were heading to the outskirts of Beirut. On their way to a checkpoint, they encountered Falange forces, who were waiting for them. This was the last known information about the passengers of the Iranian diplomatic car in Lebanon. After that, no one heard from them again, similar to what had happened with Imam Musa Sadr. The movement formed by the presence of Iranian forces in Lebanon would soon reshape relations between Lebanon and the region. A new force would be established in Lebanon, which would not only become a significant chapter for Lebanese movements like Amal, but also open a new chapter in the confrontation with Israel.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah Allahu wa la
من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. This is Zainab Musavi, and what we do in this program is to listen to certain viewpoints of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi, who was the great founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and then try to shed light and explain some precious points in their view. Well, on the subject of independence of the country, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, "A nation that gives lives to earn freedom and independence will tolerate patience, resistance, and pain in order to keep and protect them." You know, this part of Imam's speech revolves around the love of Iranian people for independence and freedom. The leader of contemporary Muslim world termed freedom not as a motto and political tool, but as a basic human right. According to Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, it is man's basic right to be free, and it is immaterial whether the freedom has anything to do with others, for example, civil and social freedom or individual freedom, which includes freedom of belief, freedom of expression, freedom of thought, freedom of parties, and freedom of press. You know, in fact, it is clear that these freedoms will not be unlimited and unconstrained. According to Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, these freedoms are limited at the point where they harm the interests of the country. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh can see that religious and country rules, which are derived from Islam, as the border of freedom, and was saying that there was a border between freedom and conspiracy in the world and in all countries. On the same pattern, the freedom was also one of the main mottos of the Islamic Revolution. Independence in all areas, abstain of affiliation, negation of aliens' intervention, and severance of strangers' influence, and not being under other supervision, are definitions which Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh gives to independence. And today, the global message of Islamic Revolution, with emphasis on faith and freedom, is inspiring people in the region after negating the deviated doctrines of liberalism and socialism. Political analysts in the West are beginning to admit these facts, and that is what Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh taught us about independence and freedom, and we are supposed to play a role in protecting and keeping these invaluable and precious concepts in our country alive. May Allah bless the soul of this great man.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say.
There was a spring of truth, a selection of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints.
Straight.
Part 1.
This is the Bab al-Mandab Strait, the Gate of Tears, and one of the most vital maritime channels in the world.
Most cargo operators now won't send their boats through the strait connecting the Red Sea with the Gulf of Aden. That's known as the Gates of Grief.
12% of the world's maritime trade is carried out through the Suez Canal, and all ships passing through this canal must pass through the Bab el-Mandab Strait, an area that has become the scene of a major international naval battle over the past year. It all started with Al-Aqsa flood operation and the beginning of the brutal Israeli aggression on Gaza. And since that date on, every week the world heard news of Israeli ships or their Western supporters being targeted in the north and south of the Bab el-Mandab Strait. Shipping companies that were in contact with the Zionist regime had two choices: to reroute around the southern tip of the African continent and make the route longer, or to accept the risk of the Ansarallah missile attacks or even the seizure of their ships in retaliation for the widespread support of Western countries for the Zionist regime's aggression against the Gaza Strip.
To put that in perspective, 90% of the world's goods, or somewhere between 70 and 90% of all the world's goods, are transported
by ship.
Yep. Okay, so 10 to 12% of that entire global effort is transiting through the Red Sea in this narrow strait.
8% of LNG, I think like 8% of grain, and I think 12% of oil. LNG actually stopped completely going through there. We haven't had an LNG ship go through since, I believe, January of this year. But the first one had a successful transit last week.
The Bab el-Mandab Strait is a major transit route between the three continents of Asia, Africa, and Europe, with about 15% of global maritime trade and 30% of the world's container traffic passing through it. As of November 2023, 500,000 containers pass through the Bab el-Mandab Strait daily.
So, Tad, the Bab el-Mandab is actually Suez Canal.
Right.
If you're going to go through the Suez Canal, you're going to go through the Bab el-Mandab. But it's absolutely important. It's one of the three key choke points in the Central Command region: the Suez Canal, the Bab el-Mandab, and of course the Strait of Hormuz.
Any disruption to maritime security in the Bab el-Mandab Strait would put a huge strain on major global shipping companies and consequently on global maritime trade. If commercial ships were to be cut off from the Bab el-Mandab Strait, the alternative route would be to circumnavigate the African continent and pass through the Cape of Good Hope in the south of the continent, which would lengthen the route by about 3,500 nautical miles and increase the time it takes to transport goods by sea from origin to destination by an average of 10 days, which would increase the ship's fuel consumption by 33%.
Yes, certainly. Well, this is all about the Suez Canal. That Red Sea is the entrance to that, and that's what the commercial shippers now are, obviously, if they're not going through there, going all the way around Africa, and that's going to impact global economy.
A few years ago, this problem occurred on a smaller scale in another maritime passage. On March 23, 2011, the Suez Canal was closed for a week until March 29th due to the grounding of the container ship, the Ever Given, which left 15 ships at harbor and at least 237 ships waiting to pass through the canal, resulting in the freezing of trade worth over $9 billion a day. Land routes can never be a substitute for strategic passages such as the Bab el-Mandab Strait or the Suez Canal because of limitations such as the volume of goods carried, border and customs problems, and the presence of a large number of countries along the route.